Chapter 8, Narrowing the Political Spectrum. "All I want to do now is make some big bucks," a physics graduate student told me as he neared completion of his PhD and was starting to look for a job. He knew this simple statement said a lot about how his goals had changed during graduate school. While he may not have even clearly remembered his original intellectual interests or his original degree of determination that his work be of benefit to society, he did realize that somewhere along the way he had become very flexible in these personal and social goals. Listening to him, I could see that he sought big bucks, not as payment for valuable skills that he would put at his employer's disposal, but as compensation for intellectual interests and social goals abandoned. Once the student abandons his own agenda, his course is set. And before long, he is working like the physicist described in Chapter 4 and 5, as if the agenda of the dominant sector of society were his own. How does the professional physicist come to abandon his own agenda and adopt an outlook that is appropriate for what physicists actually do in this society? This chapter looks at the steps. Most people, including leftists, do not think of professional training as changing people. They think of it as simply teaching people facts and skills. Anyone holding this static view of the individual will not be able to explain why professional education is the way it is, or why professionals are the way they are. Those who run professional training programs certainly take a dynamic view of the individual, and we should too, if we want to understand how they make professionals. And the first subcaption is titled, Before the Narrowing. The outlook of students completing professional training programs is markedly different from that of students entering them. By professional training programs, I mean traditional professional school as well as graduate PhD programs. While the new professionals emerge from training somewhat more conservative on average than they were when they entered, the most striking difference is that they show less diversity in their attitudes, their views of the world, the nature of their intellectual interests, the roles they see for themselves in society, the roles they think their chosen field should play in society, and their goals for society itself. The student beginning professional training is usually highly optimistic about the opportunity for an intellectually rewarding and socially beneficial career. This is certainly the case in physics, where the beginning graduate students see the kind of work physicists do as research on intriguing fundamental questions aimed at furthering human understanding of the universe, leading sooner or later to socially beneficial technology. The student enthusiastically anticipates doing creative work in this quest for seemingly eternal truth. Moreover, both the economy and the culture respect the scientist and uphold the notions that the scientist's professional work is objective, politically neutral, and universal in content. Thus, the beginning student sees the possibility for a rare combination: career work that is intellectually, materially, and socially rewarding, and that is free of political direction or interference. The expectation of political freedom follows from the student's faith that the search for truth transcends even the most serious earthly struggles for social power. The student outside the sciences anticipates the same rewards and freedom, expecting the professional status will bring autonomy in the workplace and a career free from domination by any powerful hierarchy. If students are overly upbeat about what becoming a professional can do for the individual and for society, that is not because they are naive, although naivete makes this possible. Rather, they are searching with some urgency to find a way to achieve their personal and social goals. Students are well aware that in a hierarchical society, one does not automatically get to live a life with any significant independence from management and its monitoring and control of the details of work, and even of some leisure activity. Students beginning professional training are not properly aware, however, that there is a price to pay for any independence gained by becoming a professional. A look at those who have paid the price, students emerging from professional training, gives a hint as to what the price is. Students finishing the ordeal of professional training often appear to be pressured and troubled, as if under some sort of unrelenting duress whose source they can't pinpoint. Anyone who has been around a university graduate student department or other professional school has undoubtedly seen many such students. These students end up doing much of their work while in a state of physical and mental fatigue, precluding the creativity and enjoyment that were once their priority. They are no longer the upbeat students who entered the professional training program. Students who were adamant about not wanting to become cogs in the machine, students who would join the system only on their own terms, students who stood solidly behind their own goals for society. Many of these students now have a tired, defeated look about them and an outlook to match. Many are now quite willing to incorporate themselves into one or another hierarchy and to put up no resistance there, overt or covert, as they help do the work that furthers their new employer's goals. The willingness shown by the new graduate to function harmoniously with the system is usually not the disingenuous kind shown by people who have their fundamental reservations, but who are reluctantly going along with the only choice available. The new graduate often feigns reluctance so as to maintain appearances, but it is usually painfully obvious that deep down something has changed. The individual has taken a step toward adopting the worldview of the system and goals compatible with the system. Students who once spoke critically of the system are now either silent or fearfully fair and responsible in their criticism. They are careful not to be provocative, not to do or say anything that might displease individuals in authority. Any opposition is now sufficiently abstract and theoretical to not be provocative. Don't assume that behavior motivated by fear is disingenuous. It usually isn't, because the safest way to behave in a way that will please the powerful is to do so genuinely. The most blatant examples are cases of the Stockholm Syndrome, named for a 1973 incident in which hostages taken during a bank robbery in Sweden grew to identify with their captors. Although the professional has sidelined his original goals, he usually retains some memory of them. Any such memory inevitably points to the compromises he's made and therefore can be an unrecognized source of unease in the professional's life. None of this is to imply that new professionals are left without goals. Ironically, the primary goal for many becomes, in essence, getting compensated sufficiently for sidelining their original goals. Robert H. Frank, a Cornell University economics professor, tried to find out exactly how much compensation people deem sufficient for making this sacrifice. He surveyed graduating seniors at his university and found, for example, that the typical student would rather work as an advertising copywriter for the American Cancer Society than as an advertising copywriter for Camel cigarettes, and would want a salary 50% higher to do it for the cigarette company. The typical student would want conscience money amounting to a 17% salary boost to work as an accountant for a large petrochemical company instead of doing the same job for a large art museum. Indeed, employers that are seen as less socially responsible do have to pay a moral reservation premium to get the workers they want. Frank found that men are more likely than women to sell out, and this accounts for at least part of the gap in average salaries between equal men and women. Once the professional adopts this new quantitative measure of success, the system has him in the palm of its hand, for he maximizes his compensation by working hard to further the goals of his employer, and thus the system. And work hard he does. 12-hour or longer workdays are standard for many young professionals. According to the Wall Street Journal, in some investment banking and law firms, 7-day, 100-hour work weeks aren't uncommon. At First Boston Corporation, a large international investment banking firm headquartered in New York City, young associates stay late about 3 nights a week. Other nights, they're out by 8 or 9, the chairman of the corporation's recruiting committee tells the journal. Moreover, in spite of his marathon effort and to his employer's further delight, the young professional feels that he must not be working hard enough because the compensation never quite seems to satisfy him. The feeling of having it all eludes him. In fact, his efforts are futile, for no amount of income or status can make a whole social being who has abandoned his own intellectual and political goals. The situation tends to be self-perpetuating. The professional's priority on compensation inhibits him from developing and pursuing his own intellectual and political goals, because the independent thinking necessary to do that is incompatible with the mindset necessary to do the best for his employers, and therefore to do the best in the rat race. Furthermore, the rat race is an all-encompassing effort. The young professional works the week like a sprint and is left with only a few hours of leisure time out of the week's 168 hours. To prepare his mind adequately for the professional work ahead, he must spend his hard-won free time working at relaxation, certainly not reflecting. Until the professional assigns highest importance to developing and advancing his own political goals, serving the system will not be just his job, but his life. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Going on to the next subsection of Chapter 8, which is titled Metamorphosis and Unnatural Selection. There are only two conceivable mechanisms by which those completing professional training can come to be different in outlook from those beginning it: ideological weeding out and ideological transformation. Both mechanisms, elimination and assimilation, operate at every step in the production of the professional. In physics, about half of the students who enter PhD programs leave without the degree, many due to outright expulsion. This massive elimination allows the political biases in the weeding-out process to have a strong effect on the overall political nature of the graduating class. Adjustment works hand in glove with this elimination, informing the class politically. Many of those who survive the weeding-out do so by shaping up under the threat of being culled, and in the process undergo attitudinal transformations that make them politically compatible with the others who are not weeded out. Professional physicists are produced in 5 steps: admission, courses, qualification, research, and employment. The weeding out and transformation at each step shape the character of the final product, the annual crop of new physicists. In admission, there is a small amount of weeding out and very little transformation. The large majority of applicants to physics PhD programs gain admission, and they don't have to go through many changes to do so. In courses, there is a further weeding out, and transformation gains in importance. Qualification is the step at which the system decides officially whether or not the student may, in principle, become a professional in his chosen field. It is around this stage that most of the elimination and adjustment occurs. In the student research project, there is further transformation, but only a small amount of weeding out, as few leave the field. Finally, in employment, a small amount of adjustment is often necessary, and there is also further weeding out, as some graduates never get jobs in the field. This series of steps is fairly standard for all professions whose members are a product of graduate training. The amount of weeding out and transformation at each stage of training varies from field to field and from school to school, but the basic program is the same. Although training for the traditional professions is structured somewhat differently, qualification remains the crucial step. As I discussed in the previous chapter, qualification in medicine is early, at admission to medical school. Accordingly, both transformation and weeding out operate at full force. The admission process engenders the infamous, self-centered, competitive outlook of the pre-med student and involves a high percentage of rejections. Because my main example is physics, I focus on the elements of professional training in graduate school, which is where physicists are trained, and I leave it to the interested reader to identify the corresponding elements of training in traditional professional school. Critics of education and the professions have paid very little attention to the step of qualification, even though this is where students either get the green light for careers in their chosen professions or have their hopes for such careers reduced to fantasies. The critics evidently do not see the heart of the selective system as favoring students with particular attitudes and outlooks. The critics' silence on the issue reveals the unspoken assumption that they share with the system. Qualifying is mainly a matter of meeting basic standards. The qualification process is a nonpartisan evaluation of whether or not the student is good enough to become a professional in a particular field. The question of whether or not the student qualifies is prior to any question of ideology. All questions of ideology aside, some candidates, and in some fields evidently, most of the candidates just don't have the right stuff to be professionals. So qualifying is a more personal matter than a political one. Even leftist critics of education and the professions can often be heard using the rhetoric of personal merit in informal conversation. Consider the difference between asking a student who recently took the qualifying examination, "Did you pass?" and asking the student, "Did they pass you?" These two questions reflect vastly different outlooks. People often say, "Congratulations on passing," in a way that implies, "You've shown you've got what it takes." Or they say, "I'm sorry you didn't make it," while resolving to themselves never again to mention what they consider to be a personal failure. They make the subject awkward and embarrassing by viewing it as a question of individual merit. Their focus on the student, not on the examiners, announces their general acceptance of the examiner's criteria for selection. When the issue is how good the student is, there is no criticism of what the examiners are looking for, and nothing is exposed about the true nature of the field that the selection system functions to reproduce. Every professional training program reinforces the unspoken assumption listed above by presenting its process of qualification as an unbiased assessment of the student's aptitude in the field. The central element of this assessment is the qualifying examination. This examination, which I maintain is far from neutral politically, is the centerpiece of the selection system because, ironically, as a technical test, it gives the selection system its image of neutrality. But the qualifying examination is part of the selection system not just to give that system an ideologically unbiased look. The examination is also an important part of the mechanism by which the selection system imposes its ideology. In fact, the qualifying examination is the keystone of the ideologically biased process of weeding and transformation. It serves simultaneously as an imposed objective, disciplining student goals toward the norm, and as a measure, revealing the student's degree of orientation toward that norm. I will discuss each step in the production of the professional physicist, focusing on qualification. Disillusionment can strike the student at any step in the process. In the example here, it hits late in the game, during research. Just about anyone with a bachelor's degree in physics, 4,000 are issued each year in the United States, or a related subject can, without much difficulty, apply and gain admission to a graduate program at a reputable university physics department. Nevertheless, 2/3 of the students receiving bachelor's degrees in physics do not continue toward the professional degree in physics. In fact, about half of the physics bachelor's degree recipients do not go to graduate or professional school in any subject, and so there is clearly a good deal of selection at the transition from undergraduate school to graduate school. The student's socioeconomic status is an important factor in this self-selection for graduate school. The working class student, particularly the graduate of the 4-year public college, tends to either be shut out socially, recognizing in advance that professional training is not for the likes of me, or shut out economically, being unable to enjoy the luxury of 5 or more years of freedom from the job market, usually because of family financial obligations. To get a PhD in physics requires an average of more than 6 years of graduate work. PhD-granting universities do not have the working-class atmosphere that exists at community colleges and at many public 4-year colleges, where students often hold part-time or even full-time jobs. Universities are usually park-like and located in areas where rent is high and where working-class culture and lifestyles are out of place. UCLA, where I was an undergraduate, is typical of many such universities with large graduate departments. Located in the high-priced Westwood area of Los Angeles, the campus is a middle-class camp, a place where students with middle-class values can feel comfortable as they play and study. Campus facilities help maintain the middle-class atmosphere. For example, more than a dozen eating establishments, each with its own distinctive personality, decor, and menu, operate on the campus, offering more than 800 menu items. Health and indulgence are their two most prominent themes, as evidenced by their annual consumption of over 100 tons of lettuce, 54 tons of mozzarella cheese, and 27 tons of coffee beans. Thus, a yuppie in training can lunch at an outlet featuring a baked potato bar or a 70-item salad bar, and then just a short walk away, relax at a campus facility featuring gourmet cheesecake and fresh baked goods, gourmet coffees, and custom smoothies containing fresh fruit juice blended with your choice of 12 fruit options. Of course, not all campus facilities and services correspond to middle-class culture, but even those that do not are often vehicles for what any worker coming upon the campus scene would probably see as indulging in class privilege. Only middle-class students would have the time and the money. While working-class youth are spending their days at boring jobs or at high school-like 2-year or 4-year colleges, their middle-class age mates are off enjoying themselves at universities, which many fraternity and sorority members and other middle-class students treat as amusement parks, only with lecture halls instead of rides. A daytime walk across the UCLA campus, which is built on a plot of land more than four times the size of Disneyland, finds students crowding into large pinball and video game arcades, shooting pool in a room devoted to the activity, eating made-to-order pizza and hot German pretzels, buying fudge and 130 types of candy by the ounce, lining up for frozen yogurt sundaes and banana splits, keeping the attendant at an ice cream parlor busy scooping to fill their orders, busy enough, in fact, to make it one of the largest outlets of Baskin-Robbins ice cream on the West Coast, and choosing from 10 varieties of fresh-baked, hot-from-the-oven cookies, ranging from chocolate chip and peanut butter to chocolate mint and macadamia nut. Nor are the students' academic responsibilities forgotten in all the fun. Lecture notes for more than 100 large classes at UCLA are published weekly and sold at an often crowded office on campus, supposedly to allow the student to go to class and concentrate entirely on the lecturer's words. Even though graduate students are unable to spend as much time as undergraduates participating in all this, the activity does illustrate the middle-class orientation of the institutional culture in which all students and faculty work. A visitor to the UCLA campus senses almost immediately how working-class students, particularly working-class minority students, might feel out of place at the university. The discomfort that such students feel is similar to that felt by middle-class white students who wander into one of the campus's small enclaves of other cultures, such as the hallways, offices, and minority studies libraries near the Office of Equal Opportunity Programs. The affluent student is at home at the university. The working-class student is a visitor there. Thus, it is no surprise that a study of undergraduates at the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that the upscale institution's reputation as a party school stems from the practices of affluent white students only. These economically secure students are more likely to drink, use drugs, and party frequently, and are less likely to spend time studying than are minority students and working-class white students, the study found. Clearly, working-class students at working-class four-year colleges cannot usually make the transition to a university graduate school. This helps to explain why, even though admission to physics graduate school is easy for all, students with physics bachelor degrees from four-year colleges are much less likely than their university counterparts to become physics graduate students. Physics majors who work their way through college as undergraduates may find it difficult to continue on to the professional degree as part-time students. The University of California, Irvine, is quite open about this. In general, warns the university catalog, graduate study at the physics PhD program is expected to be a full-time activity. Other proposed arrangements should be approved by the graduate committee. Close quote. The application backs this up. Individuals seeking admission must answer the question, do you intend to pursue a full-time academic program at UCI? About 96% of the 10,000 physics graduates in the U.S. PhD granting departments are full-time students. The university discourages part-time physics graduate study not to reduce the number of working-class students, but rather to maintain the conditions that are necessary for professional training. Professional schools are not in the business simply to teach college graduates more facts and skills, but to teach values as well, to produce a particular kind of individual, the professional. To do this, the university must have its graduate students' undivided attention. The student most easily trained is the one whose body and mind are on campus, who has no mental foothold, point of reference or source of critical distance outside his or her university department, and is therefore free to drift in the proper direction under the influence of the world values maintained by that department. Jobs per se are not the issue for the university. Indeed, the university itself gives half-time jobs in the physics department to most of the physics graduate students that it admits. The university's policy against part-time physics graduate students is really a policy against physics graduate students with off-campus jobs, students whose lives do not center on the campus. Whatever its primary purpose, discouraging part-time graduate study in physics does lower the number of working-class students who make the transition from undergraduate school to graduate school. And as I will explain, the half-time physics department jobs are not used to make up for this class bias in the selection of graduate students. Beginning graduate students who are given departmental employment are usually hired as teaching assistants, who do teaching and grading tasks that research-oriented faculty consider to be academic drudge work. Advanced graduate students are hired as research assistants. Physics departments can offer employment to most of the students they admit because military and industrial goals motivate large federal research budgets for physics, and the resulting contracts and grants have made physics departments among the richest on university campuses. Departments in the humanities and social sciences give financial support to fewer students and give less money to those that they do support, often by giving them fractional teaching assistant jobs. Even though the university pays graduate students only a fraction of what it pays faculty to do the same work, graduate students of all socioeconomic backgrounds who are offered these jobs take them eagerly. They do so either to save their parents money or to relieve themselves of the heavy burden of hustling money off campus while struggling in an academic program that demands total immersion for any reasonable chance of success. These jobs can mean the difference between success and failure as a graduate student. The fact that jobs are clearly exploitative, but too important to give up, has helped to spur graduate student employees at many universities to unionize and strike. Physics departments and prospective physics graduate students know the importance of the jobs and think in terms of two fundamentally different kinds of admissions to graduate school, admissions with and without an offer of employment. Employment is usually bestowed on the basis of academic achievement. It is thus most likely to go to those who didn't have a job or a cultural conflict interfering with their undergraduate studies, students from the higher socioeconomic groups. Departments use the offers of employment to attract the students they think are best and who might otherwise go elsewhere. The academically average working-class student who gets no offer of employment, but who tries to attend graduate school anyway, is at a tremendous disadvantage with respect to a similar student from a middle-class family with financial resources. The extra burden of having to leave the department to earn money goes to the working-class student, helping to perpetuate that student's relatively low academic standing. This is an example of what the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu describes as the university's tendency to transmute social hierarchies into academic hierarchies. To guide students to academic slots that correspond to the socioeconomic slots from which they come. Whether the class bias in admission to PhD programs is deliberate or merely a side effect of the university's efforts to maintain the conditions necessary for effective professional training, the university needs the bias if it is to operate anywhere near its present efficiency. Middle-class students are simply easier than working-class students to train as professionals. They're not smarter. Their attitudes and outlooks simply need less adjustment to meet the system's demands. and I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. I'm reading from Chapter 8, Narrowing the Political Spectrum, continuing with the next subsection titled Courses. Beginning physics graduate students must devote an entire year or two of their lives to homework. Indeed, the first part of physics graduate school is well described as a boot camp based on homework. One characteristic of any boot camp is that the subject matter the instructors present in their day-to-day work is not really the main thing they are teaching. Teaching the subject matter is certainly one goal, but it is not the main one. In military boot camp, for example, drill instructors make recruits spend large amounts of time learning to dress to regulation, march to precise formation, chant ditties, disassemble and reassemble rifles, carry heavy backpacks, and so on. Yet the main goal of all this is something much more profound: to create soldiers who will follow orders, even to their deaths. Similarly, the most apparent goal of graduate physics courses is to indoctrinate the students into the dominant paradigms or theoretical frameworks of physics. But the primary goal is to train physicists who will maintain tremendous discipline on assigned problems. During the first 2 years in physics graduate school, students take a fairly standard set of courses. These courses, which are up to a year in length, include the following. And then Schmidt here lists a number of courses and their descriptions, which I will abbreviate by merely telling you that these courses include classical mechanics, electricity and magnetism, quantum mechanics, mathematical physics, and thermodynamics and statistical physics. And continuing on, the same textbooks are used in universities throughout the United States for most of these courses. Fashion changes so slowly that professors often teach from the same texts that they used as students. A year-long graduate physics course typically uses a single textbook, so the student's entire collection of graduate-level textbooks may take up only a couple of feet of shelf space. As familiar as the faculty and students are with these books, they might not be able to tell you their titles, because they almost always refer to the book by the author's last names. That's in Jackson. Let's look in Sicherny. Does anyone here have Goldstein? Here, physicists are referring to the texts Classical Electrodynamics, Modern Quantum Mechanics, and Classical Mechanics, respectively. The typical course features 3 50-minute lectures per week. A pattern is usually quickly established in which the professor repeatedly fills the blackboard with equations, copying from handwritten notes, while the students try to copy each boardful into their own notes before it is erased to make room for the next. Professors usually tell their classes to feel free to ask questions, but their rushed answers quickly convey a different message, that questions impede their race to present the voluminous notes in the allotted time. Hence, after the first 2 or 3 lectures, students ask few questions, and those are usually minor points of clarification. Shouldn't that be a minus sign, or is that theta squared in the numerator? To the amusement of people passing by the classroom and glancing in, professors stick to this formal lecture pattern even when there are only 1 or 2 students enrolled in or attending the class. Students eager to develop their physical intuition see such small group lectures as missed opportunities for truly educational discussion. On the other hand, members of the cult of fact and formula see no absurdity even in the one-on-one lecture. Like any other lecture, it supplies the listener with an uninterrupted flow of valuable facts and figures. The homework usually consists of the professor's selection of problems from those appearing at the end of the chapters in the textbook. The assignments are made every week or two in each class and can be very demanding. On nights before class meetings at which homework is due, problem-solving sessions often run into the early morning or even pre-dawn hours, the only break being a food run to a nearby candy machine or junk food outlet. It is not unusual for students to miss the class itself while finishing up the assignment or fall asleep during the lecture. A final exam in every course marks the end of each semester. The exams are like the homework, more problems to solve. In fact, the exam problems are often very similar or even identical to homework problems. The exam is typically either a two-hour in-class test or a take-home test for which students may have up to a few days. While the take-home test may be pedagogically superior, it is nevertheless a grueling experience for the student. From the minute the test is handed out until the minute it is due, the student is engaged in a marathon-style effort. The fact that near-perfect papers will be competing against each other keeps the pressure high and adds to the repulsiveness of the experience. Finally, the professor assigns each student a grade, usually an A or B. By graduate school convention, anything less indicates failure. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. I'm reading from Chapter 8, Narrowing the Political Spectrum. Then you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. And continuing with the next subsection titled Qualification. A bachelor's degree in physics, admission to physics graduate school, and A's and B's in the graduate physics courses do not qualify a student to complete the work for the professional degree in physics. About half of those admitted will be eliminated before PhDs are handed out. And most of this weeding out occurs around a formal process of qualification, in which the student is either passed on for a special test or is expelled from the university. In Chapter 2, I discuss the reason the system takes professional qualification so seriously. Seriously enough in this case to expel many advanced students. Professional work is politically sensitive and so requires an individual who has not just a working knowledge of the dominant paradigms of the field, but also a willingness and ability to hold on to the attitude deemed proper for the position. This attitudinal discipline is measured in part by the discipline the student is willing to bring to assigned work, for such discipline is ultimately ideological. Courses are not sufficiently reliable as a measure of this discipline. They can succeed in their most obvious goal, giving students a working knowledge of the dominant paradigms of a field, yet leave incomplete their goal of producing people who will maintain the desired discipline on assigned work. Moreover, a course grade can sometimes be no more than what it claims to be, a measure of subject matter learned, and is therefore not a reliable measure of properly disciplined work style. This creates the need to take the students who have already passed the courses and examine them again with a qualifying examination. This massive test-to-end-all-tests is not primarily concerned with measuring the basic subject matter learned in the courses. The courses themselves have already measured that. It functions as more of a measure of commitment to a particular work style. At the University of California, Irvine, the physics department administers its physics qualifying examination once a year, just before classes begin in the fall. The rules limit the student to only 2 attempts, and the faculty may discourage particular students from even trying it a second time. The student is, quote, free to choose what year to take the test, but he must weigh his level of preparation against the increasing number of years he is gambling on his attempt to pass. Most take the test after spending at least 2 years as a graduate student. The prospect of failing the qualifying test frightens the student, even the student who is the best at answering the kind of questions used on the test. The student is frightened because his desired future as a professional in his field of interest is at stake, but he is also frightened because society does not guarantee his material security, except at a life-shortening subsistence level. It seems possible for the individual, if suddenly of no value to employers, to go overnight from a job to walking the streets, from being somebody to being nobody, from living in the suburbs to living on Skid Row, left to suffer and struggle for survival among the desperate at the bottom of society. It doesn't matter much that such individual downfall is very unlikely. By simply featuring the possibility, the system announces the fundamental insecurity of the individual. This insecurity unrelentingly haunts the student studying for the qualifying test. The student sees professional training as his chance for a secure future, with status and non-alienating work, his chance for a life free from the threat of a nightmarish trip to the bottom of the heap. An important chunk of his past is also riding on the qualifying test, because no matter how many years he has invested in preparation, coming close to passing is worth nothing in terms of attaining professional status. The years of preparation go down the drain along with the hoped-for career. The qualification system is especially terrorizing for the working-class student, whose security depends so strongly on his value to employers. The working-class student who sees himself as upwardly mobile feels that he has farther to fall, with opportunity unlikely to knock a second time. This disparity in pressure is fine with the system, because working-class students need more adjustment anyway. If the student acts like the qualifying exam is a life-and-death issue, he does so to the extent that he feels that his ultimate socioeconomic status is at stake. One consistently finds the most terrorized students doing the most work in research lab jobs, working the longest hours. What others consider shit work, they have to see as a great opportunity. And so they are the ones who end up doing it. This is another example of the university's tendency to transmute social hierarchies into academic hierarchies. The graduate student who isn't passed on the qualifying test is barred from registering for classes and is fired from his job as a teaching assistant, regardless of his job performance. His office and desk are quickly assigned to someone else. Overnight, he has become a mere visitor in the place where he had been spending most of his waking hours working and studying. His presence is suddenly very awkward, a downbeat reminder of what can be done to anyone. He gets the same kind of overly nice and overly cold treatment that people give to cancer victims. Very soon, he goes away. His name itself strikes an unhappy note and so isn't mentioned much by those with whom he spent so much time. He is a non-person. The possibility of being failed on the test scares the student for another reason: humiliation in front of family and friends. What can the student say about literally flunking out of a subject after studying it for 6 or 7 years or more? The threat of missing out on a career as a professional in his field of interest, of losing the years he has wagered on such a career, of immediate unemployment and non-person status, of humiliation as a flunk-out, these threats terrorize the student. If the student is not part of an independent organization that can analyze what is going on and raise a defense if necessary, then he may adjust his ideology to that of those with power over him when he senses that doing so will increase his chances of survival. He would make this adjustment not because he is a weak individual, but because individuals are weak. The unorganized student, like the victim of cult indoctrination or a deprogramming attempt, is caught alone. Studying for the qualifying test is an intense process, consisting almost entirely of working problems. students get the bulk of their practice problems from old qualifying exams. These problems and their solutions are like catechisms, in that they are fairly well known but not easily learned. Beginning with the student's first day in graduate school, the fraction of his effort in physics that he devotes specifically to passing the examination increases. For most students, this fraction reaches 100% months before the exam. However, the intensity of the studying usually increases beyond this measure. Test preparation, having become 100% of the student's effort in physics, expands even further until it constitutes 100% of the student's life effort. Except during the valuable hours, minutes, and seconds reluctantly rationed out to such necessities as sleeping, eating, and defecating, the student anxiously readies himself for the test. Although study schedules vary, the student typically awakens in the morning, eats a quick breakfast, and resumes his problem-solving work. 12 hours later that night, we find him still studying, having taken breaks only to eat and only when he could not concentrate. Late at night, if he is physically incapable of further concentration, he crashes. If, however, he can continue, he may feel that he must, in which case he may work far into the early morning hours. He is keenly aware that these are not extra hours. He will get a later start the next day. Weekends are merely another 48 hours to study. The intensity of the work during this period is ominous. It sets a precedent for later work on a professional job. Indeed, any accommodation that the student makes in attitude or ideology while preparing for the test will be in the direction of those who command the large amount of social power necessary to extract such a marathon effort from the student. One indication of the pressure on the student is the physical and mental toll that the preparation process takes. While I was at UCI, for example, a physics graduate student suffered permanent loss of most sight in one eye after he went through the stress of weeks of intense study for his second bout with the test. He paid a high price to be passed. Another student freaked out in the weeks before his second encounter with the test. He was not passed. Such effects go beyond the students themselves to their families. Students have no choice but to, in effect, cut themselves off from their partners and children for some months before the test. Those who are failed on the test, of course, have their problems exacerbated and have the hardest time convincing themselves that it was worth it. The test itself is typically a week-long ordeal of examination. On Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of test week at UCI, for example, the physics graduate student goes through a gauntlet of morning and afternoon sessions of written examinations on various physics subtopics. After this barrage of 7 written examinations, the student stands alone before a committee of 3 faculty members for a 2-hour oral examination. This takes place on Thursday or Friday, and each student is assigned a different committee. Members of the committee typically ask problem-type questions, and the student answers using the blackboard. At the end of the week, the entire physics faculty gathers in a closed meeting to decide the fate of the students. Strange as it may seem, in most physics departments, a student's score on the test is only one factor in the faculty's decision as to whether or not the student has passed the test. Students are not usually told their scores. This gives faculty members the option of deciding that a student has failed the test, even if the student has outscored someone they are going to pass. In arriving at their personal opinions on whether to pass or fail a student, individual faculty members consider anything and everything they know or think they know about that student, including impressions carried away from informal discussions with the student and with others around the department. A faculty member who talks informally with a student in the hallway or at the weekly after-colloquium reception inevitably comes away with a feeling about whether or not that student thinks like a physicist. The student's political outlook can easily make a difference in the faculty member's assessment. For example, in the usual informal discussion of an issue in the news, the student who rails against technical incompetence and confines his thoughts to the search for technical solutions within the given political framework builds a much more credible image as a professional physicist than does the student who emphasizes the need to alter the political framework as part of the solution. Indeed, the latter approach falls outside the work assignments given to professional physicists in industry and academe, and so represents thinking unlike a physicist's. When everything else is equal, the student who is known around the department has the advantage of personal relationships with faculty members. Disadvantaged once again is the part-time student, or the student who must work off campus. These students are not seen much in the halls, in the student and faculty offices, or at the colloquia or at the teas. The image of these students as part of the physics community is apt to be weak when the faculty decides on qualification. Anxiety runs high at the faculty meeting. Most faculty are perfectly comfortable with an authoritarian system that dictates who passes and who fails, especially a rationalized authoritarian system in which the scores, not the professors, do the dictating. However, with its consideration and evaluation of all aspects of the candidate's life, the authoritarian system has its totalitarian moment, and at that moment it passes final judgment on the career plans of the individual. Some faculty feel overexposed taking such a direct hand in the process. Sometimes the result is much discussion and debate about who to pass and who to fail, especially if the test scores don't match the preferences of all the faculty members. The magic of the test, though, is that such conflict usually doesn't arise. The decision indicated to the faculty by non-physics considerations, such as attitude, almost always agrees with the decision that would have been reached by consideration of the test score alone. That is, the student who has an outlook that the faculty doesn't like, and whom the faculty does not want to pass, usually, but not always, gets lower test scores than those the faculty wants to pass. A master's degree is almost always given to those who are not passed on the exam. This degree is not highly regarded by the faculty or students at PhD granting institutions, and is readily tossed out as a consolation prize for those who are to be discouraged from going on, to use the words of the National Academy of Sciences. The master's degree, and sometimes the offer to let the student take the test another time, is given to cool out the student. It also serves to console the consciences of the faculty who kick the student out. Those who are not passed on their second encounter with the test don't get a second booby prize, just a kick in the butt. It is hard to forget scenes involving these victims of the qualification system. Bill E., near his desk, packing his books and papers into boxes after freezing up during the test. Tom B.'s wife rushing down the hall behind her husband to a professor's office in outraged disbelief that Tom had been failed for the last time, as if it were some sort of horrible mistake, running as if toward murderers standing over her husband's body. The qualification system clearly has a permanent effect on the lives of those it weeds out. But does the process of qualification have a permanent effect on students who qualify? The answer to this question is no for some students and yes for others. The student who is detached from the subject in which he is majoring, for example, the student who has chosen his major mainly because it is the subject offering the highest income and status potential of all the subjects in which he thinks he could succeed, sees qualification as just another hurdle to be vaulted, just some more prescribed alienated labor, and is little affected by doing this work. By alienated labor, I mean work that the individual wouldn't do if he didn't have to. Such work is not intrinsically satisfying but serves the interests of someone else. Today the educator, who is producing trained people, tomorrow the employer who owns the product of the laborer's work. The sign of non-alienated labor is the disappearance of the distinction between work and play for the individual doing it. Non-alienated labor is usually more intense than alienated labor. However, the student who loves the subject and is not alienated from it is profoundly affected by the qualification process. The process of preparing for the qualifying test, because of the kind of questions on the test and the way they must be answered, tragically alienates this student from his or her own field of interest. The test emphasizes quick recall, memorized tricks, work on problem fragments, work under time pressure, endurance, quantitative results, comfort with confinement to details, comfort with a particular social framework, comfort with the hierarchical division of labor, and so on. And it de-emphasizes physical insight, qualitative discussion, exploration, curiosity, creativity, history, philosophy, and so on. This forces the student who wants to be passed to adopt an industrial view of the subject, to view it as an instrument of production, to use it in an alienated way. The next two chapters look in greater detail at how the test's format and questions alienate the student from the subject. Because few careers in physics can be pursued outside one or another institutions, students who, for love or money, want careers in physics must obtain the credentials that the employing institutions demand. Students in this bind have little choice but to plunge into the intense and protracted test preparation process. The lovers of physics insist to themselves that the alienated labor involved is just temporary, that it is just to get over a hurdle beyond which lies the opportunity to do physics the way it is supposed to be done. Everyone has had the experience of being motivated by interest to work on a hobby or project with great dedication and perseverance. To prepare adequately for the qualifying test, the individual must maintain this kind of discipline on the practice problems for a seemingly unending period of time. Motivated, however, not by his interest in old exam problems, but by his desire to be allowed to pursue his interests in the subject. Hence, even if the student finds some of the practice problems interesting, the preparation process sets the stage for his alienation from the subject. For he labors on the practice problems because he is under threat of expulsion, and he labors on them not in a satisfying way, but hurriedly, because of the large number of problems he must cover. The exam ends not only hundreds of hours of explicit preparation, but also thousands of hours of indirect preparation. Courses taken, work done, and problems discussed with the test in the back of the student's mind. Students should not cavalierly label their alienated labor as merely temporary, as instrumental to get the degree, but easily reversed afterwards. Performing intense alienated labor for an extended period of time changes the student. It dampens his creativity and curiosity, clouds his memory of his original interests and ideas, and weakens his resolve to pursue them, while getting him used to doing protracted, disciplined labor on assigned problems. It is empty rhetoric to tell the student who has gone through the qualification process that he is free now to pursue his career's original goals, for he is now a different person. What the student thought was a temporary concession to the system, "I'll play along just enough so that I can get what I want from the system," turns out to be the beginning of a forced permanent adjustment to the system. The alienated work that the student did to prepare for the qualifying exam, work that was merely to assure his future, is his future. It may seem strange that the student has to demonstrate his willingness and ability to perform alienated labor in his subject of interest to be allowed a career in that subject. However, from one point of view, this requirement is appropriate, because a certain amount of alienation makes the student better able to stomach most jobs in his field, which require disciplined work on assigned problems. The qualifying exam measures the student's willingness and ability to lead such an employer-oriented work life. Being passed on the qualifying test is less a politically neutral mark of intellectual achievement or self-discipline than it is a demonstration to future employers of a readiness to play by the rules at work. In practical terms, being passed on the professional qualifying exam means being permitted to begin a kind of apprenticeship, the nature of which depends upon the field. During this apprenticeship, the professional-to-be learns more technical skills, but the main lessons are on the protocols, communication skills, and organizational skills that the professional uses to practice the tricks of the trade. Although these skills vary from one profession to another, they typically include how to organize a work project, deal with clients, write reports, make presentations at professional meetings, and delegate work to assistants and secretaries. The student who has been passed on the qualifying examination is a bit like the son of the chairman of the board of a corporation who has been given a job in the mailroom. The son differs from other workers in the mailroom in that he is on the track to an executive position, as everyone in the company knows without being told. Similarly, those passed on a qualifying examination are not yet professionals, but there is little doubt that it is just a matter of time before they will be. The institution that examined them has agreed in principle to make them professionals. There is usually no doubt that the student can learn the technical and non-technical skills that he or she is expected to pick up after the qualifying exam, even though doing so may require many hours of hard work. The student already has the most crucial qualities of the professional. Those who staff the training institutions certainly act in accord with this view. Students who are passed on the exam often report an abrupt and bewildering improvement in the way they are treated by faculty members and others. As professionals in principle, they are already junior members of the club. And I'm reading from Chapter 8 of Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. The title of this chapter is Narrowing the Political Spectrum. Going on to the next subsection titled Research. The graduate student who qualifies must do one more thing to get the degree: work on a multi-year research project under the supervision of a faculty member. Whether the student works on a self-contained research problem or on a problem that is just one part of a large research project, the years of work serve to induct him into a particular field and get him accustomed to doing research in the standard way. The nature of the student's research problem, the way the student gets the problem, and the way the student works on the problem are all reminiscent of industrial research. First, the problem is usually narrow and of little general intellectual interest. Second, the student rarely develops the problem himself. Instead, he chooses his research topic from the problems that faculty members are planning to work on. The professor who supplies the problem, which is usually very similar to problems on which the professor and his previous graduate students have done extensive work, becomes the student's dissertation advisor. Third, the student will toil on this problem 50, 60 or more hours per week for 4, 5, 6 or more years, doing work that is more often tedious than not. Much of the creative part of the work is done by the student's advisor, who is often the student's employer as well, during meetings with the student. At these meetings, which are often weekly, but which may be daily if the professor employer is a slave driver type, the student gets instructions on what to do next, usually called suggestions. In scientific fields, these are typically ideas about what to modify in a calculation, a computer program, an electronic system, or whatever. The student goes off, tries to get it to work, and reports the results at the next meeting. The choice of a research topic is particularly important for students headed for university jobs. More often than those who get jobs in industry, these students end up spending their entire careers working in the same subfield that their graduate student research topic came from, and often on closely related topics within that subfield. Even when every professor and research group in the department is willing to take on a particular student to work on an available problem, that student is far from free to choose one of the available problems. Subfields vary widely in the financial support available for graduate students, in job prospects after graduation, and in the number of years it takes to get the degree, and in the general intellectual interest of the problems addressed. Because of these differences, the student's socioeconomic class and cultural background play an important role in his choice of subfield and topic within that subfield. Students from more secure backgrounds exercise freer choices, and students from less secure backgrounds are more subject to the channeling of curiosity and career that was described in chapters 4 and 5. The less secure students are driven into subfields that offer immediate and continuing financial support. This support usually takes the form of a research assistantship, in which the student's advisor or group leader hires the student to assist in a research project, using money from a federal contract or grant issued for that work. The research problem that the student has been given is a part of that work. So, from the student's point of view, the student is hired to work on his own research project. Most students would rather be a research assistant than a teaching assistant, so as to devote more time to their research and thereby graduate sooner. Well-funded subfields offer more and more secure research assistantships. Secure assistantships are not going to expire after a year or two when a one-time grant runs out. They come from groups with ongoing government research contracts or multiple research grants that are regularly renewed. Hence, students tend to develop a special intellectual interest in well-funded subfields. In fact, students find the research problems in these subfields doubly interesting because subfields that are well-funded at the university are usually the ones that offer the best job prospects after graduation. University research in these subfields is funded so heavily because the subfields are areas of heavy commercial or military activity. Students know that job prospects vary greatly by subfield and are well aware of which subfields the marketplace has deemed hot. Thus, 27 physics graduate students take an interest in condensed matter physics, the basis of electronic devices, for everyone who takes an interest in acoustics, and 30 take an interest in nuclear physics for everyone who takes an interest in geophysics. Also, at a given school, it often takes many more years to get a PhD in some subfields than others. Students from less secure backgrounds are more likely to choose one of the quicker subfields, or at least one of the surer research problems, even though such a problem is also certain to be more routine and of less general intellectual interest. A significant number of graduate students now get their research training by participating in large research projects in which the work is organized in a way that matches the industrial model even more closely. As industrial research has become more and more specialized, university research too has tended toward a focus on narrower problems and to increasing division of labor in the pursuit of those problems. The ever finer division of labor is particularly apparent in subfields where experiments are undertaken by large university research groups or by collaborations of research groups from many institutions. In particle physics, for example, accelerator laboratories such as CERN near Geneva, Switzerland, the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois, near Chicago, and the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center in Stanford, California, now play host to collaborations that bring together hundreds of physicists for a single experiment. Such experiments can span a decade from the overall planning and the design, construction, and testing of the particle detectors to the collection and analysis of the data and the publication of all the results. A graduate student working on such an experiment typically gets to know just one of the many pieces of the apparatus involved. After collecting the data, the various groups in the collaboration typically divvy it up for analysis at their home institutions. Graduate students usually analyze some part of the work for their degrees. Whether the graduate student has worked in a large group or alone, when at long last he completes what he understood to be the agreed-upon work, typically he is dismayed to find that his advisor sees things differently. The advisor never seems to stop asking for another measurement or another calculation. When the advisor finally relents, the student writes a lengthy description of his research, the dissertation. He gives a talk and answers questions about his work before a small audience at a defense of dissertation ritual, and then receives the PhD degree. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Right now I'm reading from Chapter 8, which is titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum. Going on to the next subsection titled Disillusionment. Are we having fun yet? This would be a cruel question to ask graduate students during the research phase of their training. It would rub in the fact that the temporary compromises they made to get past the qualifying examination are still very much in effect and are going to remain so at least until the end of graduate school, which may be years away. This predicament, and the way the student gets into it, was the subject of an insightful satirical article published anonymously during the Vietnam War. The article appeared in a truly underground newspaper. The Physics Free Press was a short-lived tell-it-like-it-is publication, produced secretly and distributed nationally by graduate students and postdoctoral research fellows who had to remain anonymous for their own protection. The article, apparently written by a solid-state physicist, is part of a response to the shortage of physics jobs at the time. However, it is mainly a response to a training system in which students expecting to do exciting, important work find themselves instead confined to narrow technical problems that have been detached from the larger goals that engender them, or worse, that are situated in a socially reactionary context, such as that of the military or the powerful corporations. Here is the article in its entirety. Steps to Disillusion a Young Physicist. As you walk into Dr. Fartsworth's office, you timidly wonder, why would the world's distinguished expert on low-temperature thermal conductivity of doped CAF ever agree to take me as a graduate research assistant? Me, with my B+ in solid state, and him, with his Natural Academy of Science membership, consultantship with ITT, 150 published works, and well-chewed pipe. I was in his course, but I wonder if he ever saw me. Step 2. As he puffs pipe smoke in your face, he tells you his research group is large, but yes, he can take on one more student in the fall. He gives you a stack of his most recent works for you to read. You're in the group. Step 3. Let's see, what are Fartsworth's articles? Refinement of Pariser Par Popel calculations on pseudo-medium crystals. Low-temperature thermal conductivity of lanthanum fluoride's deviation from Debye approximation. Splitting of metastable 4F5D excited configuration in crystalline GDCAF2 at low temperatures. A twinge of boredom and frustration touches down, but you chase it away with the thought you are reading real science. Pariser Par Popel methods apply to GD-doped CAF2. Does Fartsworth really like this SHIT? Step 4. Well, there you are, fixing the leak in the vacuum system which insulates the liquid helium, which cools the neodymium strontium chloride crystal, which needs to have a splitting in its absorption spectrum looked at for some reason. Step number 5. Fartsworth gets the funds to take you to the Gordon Solid State Conference in Boulder, Colorado. He invites you, you say, yes, as you think, wow, near the Rockies. I can get in some hiking. Apparently, Fartsworth wants to keep up with new developments in calcium fluoride. Sure he does, right? Step number 6. The lobby and conference rooms of the Boulder Hilton are filled with well-dressed Dr. Fartsworths from all over the country. A debutante's ball of physicists. A veritable mutual admiration society for the peacocks of physics, all circulating from clump to clump, talking and building their reputations. Step number 7. Fartsworth advises you. Don't talk about your neodymium experiment with Jim Weiss over there. He's in the same field. Gee, I hope his vacuum system is busted too, or he'll publish first. You think, it's okay, you talk to Jim Weiss about the weather in Colorado, and he slyly doesn't mention neodymium either. Hey, there's Stan, one of Fartsworth's former students. Hiya, Stan, what you doing here? Stan looks grim. He tells you how he can't find a job after 2 years as a postdoc, so now he's scavenging around the big shots in the lobby hoping to discover a tentative job offer. He can't talk long because there are hundreds of young physicists around the lobby looking for the same dough, and he must resume the hunt. Step 8. The travel grant paid for the plane fare and hotel for this conference, $815. Enough to pay a postdoc 1 month, but now Fartsworth is using it up in his 10-minute talk on lanthanum-doped CAF2. That's $81.50 per minute. You think, is 10 minutes nearly long enough to summarize 2 years of research? Or maybe it's 10 minutes too long. But you learn fast in those 10 minutes. Fartsworth's goal is to glibly mention ideas it took both of you 2 months to fully grasp, to be both confusing and smooth, bored and witty, and above all, to impress. And the audience is impressed. A few wise guys make attempts to steal away the victory with irrelevant and puzzling questions, but Fartsworth can handle them. He's a real pro. Everyone is properly bamboozled, and Fartsworth is smiling. 10 minutes later, after the next talk, no one in the room remembers anything about lanthanum-doped CAF2. But they do remember Dr. Fartsworth. Mission accomplished. Step number 9. You finally complete your first paper. But even its appearance in a highly respected and thick biweekly journal sandwiched between two other equally dull and opaque articles fails to alleviate your growing boredom and disillusionment with a career in physics. A career that once seemed to promise excitement, glamour, and importance. Are you going to spend your whole life in a mad, cutthroat ego trip just to see your name in print every 6 months? Or is the real pleasure in seeing your name referenced in someone else's useless article? Step number 10. The Morning Tribune headline grabs your throat. Campus anti-war crazies invade computer center. Bastards. They sure have balls, though. Don't they have any respect for anything? Maybe they're not so crazy. Those punks screwed up some professor's military contracted programs. Far trucking out. You don't like violence, but the computer takeover looks more relevant to you than anything that sat on your lab bench for the last 2 years. Step number 11. The university faculty meeting is discussing how to preserve its academic chastity in the face of the computer's rape by anti-war demonstrators and other crazy hoods. One professor, highly respected for his public spiritedness, as indicated by his association with the Institute for Defense Analysis and Defense-Related Problems, sobs that 2 years of his work on simulated bombing missions has been destroyed by anti-war violence. A poli-sci professor indignantly declares that his files on elites and leadership in anti-communist Cambodians, prepared for the State Department, have been stolen and published in a local underground newspaper, a clear violation of his academic freedom. Then Professor Fartsworth gets up to denounce the freaks, saying that computers and electronics are the greatest advance for civilization since the TV, and therefore to attack a computer is an uncivilized act. Of course, he doesn't mention the untold advantages of electronic, computerized warfare to the civilians of Vietnam. The professors are now finished farting in unison against the threat to their collective existence, and return to their offices to individually resume slitting each other's professional throats, perhaps to emerge again if their academic freedom is again touched by the turmoil of the real world. Step number 12. By now, your irrelevant research project, the ego-based seminars and conferences, the race to publish, the social hypocrisy of your professors, all these are bringing you to unexpected conclusions about the world of physics. It is a world full of corrupting contradictions, just like any other big business. Mutual cooperation is only a route to personal advancement. Communication is meant to confuse. Progress is measured in published papers per year, quantitatively, just like GNP, and just like the economy. Big physics thrives via hypocrisy, competition, deception, waste, and irrelevancy. The startling similarity between big physics and private big business is no accident either. Consultantships, research for industry, and technological aids to imperialist wars all put physics in the service of big business, sometimes directly, but often indirectly through the government. Both physics and business are based on the every-man-for-himself principle. Although there are a few winners, the Seaborgs and Tellers in physics and the DuPonts and Rockefellers in business, most everyone else loses through disillusionment, mental anguish, and the threat, now real, of imminent unemployment. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. And I'm reading from Chapter 8, which is titled Narrowing the Political Spectrum, in which he's describing the steps in graduate school by which the young students' ideals are broken to the yoke of corporate service. And going on to the final subsection, employment. The student who by some malfunction of the system graduates without having gotten used to performing disciplined labor on assigned problems, that is, the student who has not developed an assignable curiosity and has not accommodated to being a top flunky in someone's hierarchy, even this student is not home free. As he seeks career work, it becomes clear that although he may remember his original goals, He is not trained to pursue them, having spent his time working in the prescribed direction, maintaining the prescribed attitude. However, his demonstrated ability to do disciplined intellectual work in his field upon command, to temporarily, quote-unquote, suspend his prerogative to shape the world in his own way through his intellectual work, and to perform alienated intellectual labor, this skill, however it is phrased, and no matter how much he dislikes exercising it, is valuable in the marketplace. Thus, he soon finds himself employed, doing work all too familiar, work similar to what he previously accepted only because it was to be temporary, only to get the degree. This is not to say that even the product of a malfunctioning training system is doomed to work as a complete ideological servant of the very status quo he wants to change. He can remain a force for change, but only by joining with like-minded professionals and non-professionals to act on issues involving the content of his work. When the professional training system does not malfunction, it selects and produces people who are comfortable surrendering political control over their work, people who are not deeply troubled by the status quo, and who are willing and able to do work that supports it. Nevertheless, some jobs subject the graduates to further scrutiny and conditioning. For example, in a university job, which must lead either to tenure or dismissal, the graduate finds himself in a new multi-year qualification struggle, with all the attendant conservatizing effects. To qualify for tenure, the assistant professor must get as much published as possible, and so he pursues the work that he knows best, topics closely related to his dissertation, and he does this work in the way most likely to meet the approval of journal referees, namely, conservatively, being careful not to raise any controversy. Whether the young professional has surrendered political control through the normal process of qualification, or by somehow slipping through the qualification system but then failing to conspire with like-minded people, he turns his effort toward achieving along more traditional lines. Thus the yuppie finds himself running in the conventional rat race. He follows the course of this race obediently and aggressively with all his energy. He measures his progress quantitatively now, in tender valued through the system, bucks pulled down, possessions accumulated, position attained. Scientists are no less likely than other professionals to follow this course. The university scientist gets recognition, status, promotions, and raises by publishing papers. The industrial scientist keeps score by publishing papers and also by getting patents. Thus, the scientist whose bottom line is defined by the market is likely to view a research project in terms of the papers or patents that can be mined from it. There must be many such scientists, as scientific journals are filled with papers on narrow topics of little interest that have obviously been published more to advance careers than to advance knowledge. Nothing reveals more clearly the degree to which employed professionals are alienated from their subjects than does the sharply contrasting behavior of the hobbyists or buffs in their fields. When hobbyists encounter one another at social gatherings, before long you find them talking eagerly about the content of their subject of common interest, showing an excitement, enthusiasm, wonder, and curiosity that is reminiscent of beginning professional students. This rarely happens when professionals talk casually with their colleagues, unlike the amateurs. The professionals don't talk much about the work itself. They often appear detached from their subject, as if they don't derive much satisfaction from it. Yes, they talk shop, but their focus is so far from the content of the work itself that you would have a hard time if you had to guess what kind of shop they worked in. A commercial bank, a junior high school, a government agency, a university department. Casual conversation among professionals tends to focus on the actions and personalities of employers and powerful figures within their fields, the standard gossip topics of the powerless. The gossip is by no means idle, however. for the politics are central to their work as professionals. Thus, at the wine and cheese reception after an English department colloquium, a first-year graduate student musters the courage to approach the speaker, a well-known professor from another university, and ask a question about literature. But before the conversation has gotten very far, a local faculty member walks up and derails it with a question he has been waiting to ask. "Is Jones really planning to leave Yale? I heard a rumor." Soon the two professors are engrossed in a wide-ranging discussion about job openings around the country, research grants, book contracts, journal editors, and who's jockeying for power in the field. The graduate student, realizing that the conversation is not going to return to the evidently less important topic of literature, retreats back into the crowd. Versions of this generic scene occur frequently in every field. The professors here symbolize the tragedy of all employed professionals who started out as students loving their subjects. Such students submit themselves to the process of professional training in an effort to be free of the marketplace. But instead of being strengthened by the process, they are crippled by it. Deprived of political control over their own work, they become alienated from their subjects and measure their lives by success in the marketplace.